Hi, Cliff Goldstein here, and welcome back to the show. I'd like to begin by reading the few opening lines of a book. It reads, "In accordance with the law, the death sentence was announced to Sinitatis C in a whisper. All rose, exchanging smiles. The hoary judge put his mouth close to his ear, panted for a moment, made the announcement, and slowly moved away, as though ungluing himself. Thereupon, Sinitatis was taken back to the fortress." Thus begins a book called, the novel, called The Invitation to a Beheading, originally written as part of a series of articles in a Russian emigre magazine in 1938. The author was Vladimir Nabokov, I guess, I'm not sure how the proper pronunciation, who was considered one of the greatest writers of the 20th century. And indeed, going by this book, Invitation to a Beheading, I think it's a fair assessment. Nabokov was born in 1899 and died in 1997 in Switzerland. He came from a well-to-do, even aristocratic Russian family who... due to the Russian Revolution, which didn't look too kindly on well-to-do old Russian aristocratic families, they had to flee after the revolution. He moved to the West and through the course of the century published numerous books, probably his most famous being Lolita, about an old man who couldn't find anybody his own age to play with. And among his works is this fascinating book, Invitation to a Beheading. The English version was translated by Nabokov's son, Dmitri, under the father's supervision. And as we saw from the opening line, it starts out about a man, Sinitatis C, who was sentenced to death, to a beheading, and then brought back to prison, this huge castle in which, for most of the story, he's the only prisoner, and he's there to await the execution of his sentence. His crime? He was told it was for Gnostic turpitude. Gnostic turpitude. What this is we're never really openly told, at least not very openly. But that's pretty much the plot of the book. The last days of this man waiting to die. The book itself, in its own way, is kind of a strange mixture of Albert Camus' The Stranger, George Orwell's 1984, and Franz Kafka's The Castle. And in a sense, it touches on many of these themes, only more. Indeed, however bizarre and surreal much of the action and the characters are in this book, the book does itself raise some questions that I would think it would be good for all of us to ponder. In other words, it's a strange book with a strange plot, and yet at the same time it brings up issues that are worth looking at. For starters, after being told by the judge that he is to die, Sinitatis is brought back to his fortress, his prison, and after a little while, the director of the prison, the warden, I guess that's what you would call him, comes in and talks to Sinitatis. Sinitatis, I should say. And Sinitatis asks him if he knows when the sentence will be executed. And the director says he doesn't know and that he's never told, and it frustrates him, but there's just nothing he could do about it. He just doesn't know. So Sinitatis is told he's going to die, but he's not told when. And here's how he replies. He says, "I want to know why," meaning, you know, he wants to know when he's going to die, "for this reason. The compensation for a death sentence is knowledge of the exact hour when one is to die, a great luxury, but one that is well earned. However, I am being left in that ignorance which is tolerable only to those living at liberty. And furthermore, I have in my head various projects that were begun and interrupted at various times. I shall simply not pursue them if the time remaining before my execution is not sufficient for their orderly execution." Now, interesting, this is a theme that keeps reoccurring through the book right up until the very end when he is led away to execution. And that is, when will he die? It's funny, too. It's kind of strange because he has this writing project that he's working on. And he wants to finish the writing project, but he wants to know even if he should bother on it because, after all, if he's going to die soon, why bother? Why bother with the project? You know, it's funny. In its own strange way, this kind of predicts our own human predicament, doesn't it? I mean, with the exception of those very unfortunate and sad ones who are planning suicide, or those who are basically told by their doctors that that their medical condition leaves them out, you know, you only got so much time to live. The rest of us don't know how much time we have, do we? We all live with that kind of uncertainty about our end. Who knows if we'll have the time to finish our products, to finish the things we start. Then you got to wonder if we're going to die, what's the purpose of it anyway? We know every day, folks are killed in accidents or through violence or through some unexpected sickness that takes them down, you know, instantly. Folks who are right smack in the middle of the thing, of projects, plans, dreams, and then just like that, pow, boom, kazam, in an instant, they're gone. And yet at the same time, who of us lives thinking that I don't want to do this or I don't want to do that because, well, I might die tomorrow. I might eat too much Haagen-Dazs and clog my arteries and die of a heart attack tomorrow. Or I might get killed in a car wreck, so I'm not going to do anything. If we thought logically like that, we would go out of our minds. So in this rather, admittedly bizarre way, Nabokov catches through Cincinnatus and his predicament a little bit of our own predicament. Cincinnatus is just being very logical. He knows that death is coming. He knows that it will be soon, but he doesn't know us when. Now, for us, okay, maybe death won't be soon, whatever that is, though it could be. And so you could think, what's the sense in doing anything that we're doing? What's the sense of life itself if it's always going to end in death? And it always does. The thing is, we just don't think about it that way. As I said, we'd go nuts if we did. And yet it's really a very logical thing to think about, isn't it? I mean, I guess when it comes to things like death, though, we're better off not getting too logical, are we? Thus, basically, what Nabokov makes us do with Cincinnatus' unique situation is it makes us at least think about our own a little more. Think about the implications of our mortality, something that we folks generally don't like doing because it presents a pretty tough picture, doesn't it? Now, there's another element that comes through the book again and again. And that is the very strange actions and customs and values of all the characters that you meet in the book. Right off the bat, after Cincinnatus' return to prison, his jailer, Rodion, the guard who seems to be perpetually at the door and looking in on him, he offers to dance a waltz with Cincinnatus, which they do. I mean, dance a waltz with a prisoner on the day that he's told he's going to die? Then, on day 3 after his death sentence, his lawyer comes to visit him in the jail cell. Yet, apparently, along the way, he lost a cufflink coming in, and all he could do is talk about the cufflink that he lost. For the first part of the conversation, that's all he's talking about is his cufflink. I mean, he says here, this is his lawyer coming in to see his client who just got sentenced to get his head chopped off. The lawyer comes in and says, I lost a cufflink. Must have rushed against someone, which I was with sweet Emmy. She's always so full of mischief. Every time I drop in, at the point is that I heard something, but I didn't pay any look. The chain must have. I was very fond. Well, it's too late now. Maybe I can still on and on and on. I mean, again, kind of ironic, don't you think about it? I mean, here he is, his prisoner's facing death, and he comes in all happy until he loses his cufflink, and then that makes him depressed. What a bunch of nonsensical things to talk about in front of a man just sentenced to death. But see, the point is, these kind of things are found all through the book. just totally bizarre people saying and doing very bizarre things. People with a lot of strange habits and strange customs, things that don't really make sense, things that actually border on the absurd. I know there's one scene when the warden comes in. The book is filled with it. I could spend probably 2 hours just going through this, different things. In one scene, the warden comes in and greets Cincinnatus like this. "Well, how is our doomed friend today?" Okay, nice way to talk to someone. In another scene, this was funny, and probably the most famous of the book, his wife Martha comes to visit him. Now, that wouldn't be so bad, except that in the story, she comes with just about all of her family. And she brings her furniture and her children, one of whom is Lane, whom she had with other men when she was married to Cincinnatus. Yes, this is in the story. His wife is cheating on him from the beginning with a lot of men, and that's just the way it was. Well, anyway, try to picture this scene. She's coming to visit him in jail, and she brings all these people with her to the jail and their furniture, just to give you an idea of just how bizarre some of the stuff is in this book. The entire family of Martha had arrived for the interview, bringing with them all their furniture. Not thus he had imagined this long-awaited meeting. He'd been wanting to talk to his wife for a long time. How they lumbered in. Martha's aged father with his huge bald head and bags under his eyes, and the rubbery tap of his black cane, Martha's brother, identical twins except one had a golden mustache and the other had a pitch black one, Martha's maternal grandparents, so old, I love this line, so old that one could already see through them, three vivacious female cousins who, however, were not admitted for some reason at the last minute, Martha's children, Lane Demenadon and obese little Pauline. At last, Martha herself, wearing her best black dress with a velvet ribbon around her cold white neck and holding a hand mirror, a very proper young man with a flawless profile, was constantly at her side. And then, in the midst of their discussions with all these people, the father-in-law, here's this, the father-in-law comes in, he's there, one of the people coming in with the whole gang into the jail, and he says, Cincinnatus is talking to him, and he says, "Silence, insolent fellow," shouted the father-in-law. "I am entitled to expect from you, if only today, when you stand at death's door, a little respect. How you managed to get yourself on the block, I want an explanation from you. How could you? How you dared?" And then finally, his brother-in-law says to him, again, one of those that comes in, "Listen to me," the brother-in-law was saying, breathing hotly. "I'm your old pal. Do as I say. Repent, my little Cincinnatus. Come on, do me this favor. You don't know, they still might let you off. Eh? Think how unpleasant it is to have your chump lopped off. What do you have to lose? Come on, don't be a blockhead." Okay, now again, thinking of the play on words here, to have your chump lopped off. What have you got to lose? Come on, don't be a blockhead. Okay, now all this insanity is he's trying to get a few private words in with his wife, who apparently came with her latest lover, and he was never able to talk with her. She started to get a headache, and then everyone just started packing up all the furniture and dishes and all the things they brought to the jail in order, and then they left. Okay? And then they left. Now let's see what else happens here. At one point, okay, notice the line, and then it says she kissed his hand as custom demanded. At one point when she left, she kissed his hand as custom demanded. Now all this is very strange, to be sure. And then it gets even stranger when a new inmate on death row is brought in to live next to Cincinnatus. Pierre is his name, and he just kind of intrudes into Cincinnatus's life, and Cincinnatus, stumble on that, finds him very annoying. At one point, this is interesting, Cincinnatus asks his new roommate next door, Pierre, what happened to him that he got brought to the castle? And here's how he replies. He says to him, You will be amazed. I was accused of attempting to, oh, ungrateful, distrustful friend. I was accused of attempting to help you escape from here. Later on, Cincinnatus asked him if that was really true, that he was sentenced to death for helping him to escape, you know, because Cincinnatus knew nothing about it. And Pierre replied the following. He says, let us leave the matter. Decide for yourself, distrustful friend, one way or another, but I ended up here because of you. And I'll tell you more. We shall mount the scaffold together. Now, see, that was true. They would mount the scaffold together. But it wasn't as one would expect, because it turns out that his fellow prisoner, Pierre, is really the executioner, the one who was going to chop off his head at the still undisclosed time in the future. And as I said, this is all very strange, as you got an idea from this book, from the little bit that I've read to you so far. But now, the question I ask you now, though, is we want to look at is why? What does this mean? Why did he write this book about this absurd prison scene with these absurd characters? Well, you know, again, I can't get into Nabokov's mind. I don't know, you know, ultimately. And in fact, there have been a lot of literary critics have been debating for years over the meaning of the book. But what I see here with Nabokov's invitation to a beheading is a very unique way of challenging what our traditional customs, what our traditional ways of doing things, what our traditional ways of treating people, what our traditional ways of thinking. Everything in this book is all turned upside down, inside down, and upside down, inside out, and backwards. And I think it was Nabokov's way of causing of us all to look at our own customs, traditions, and so forth. I mean, let's think of the title. Invitation to a tea party, invitation to a birthday party, invitation to an inaugural. No, it's invitation to a beheading. Very strange, and it's supposed to be. You know, it's very hard, isn't it, to step out of your own skin and to look at the world from a total other perspective. You know, we're so used to doing things our ways that we come to think our ways are the only right ways. And then we're baffled and we're astonished when folks do things differently or think differently. We all view the world through very subjective frames. There's really this no purely objective view from nowhere that any of us have, is there? And I think with this book, with this strange book, we're being forced to take a whole new look at how we view the world, how we view what is right and wrong, how we view what is good and evil, how we view reality itself. Because all through this book, reality acts differently than we're accustomed to it. In other words, it's not just the strange people and their strange habits and their strange words and so on. I mean, reality itself in the book, things appear and then disappear. One moment you're with him in one place, another moment you're with him in another. At times he's dreaming and then he's awake and you're not sure totally which is which. And again, it's all a question of what is reality? What is it really like? Is the world all that we touch, see, feel, and taste? Or is there more out there? All of this, with Nabokov's book, Invitation to a Beheading, is brought into question. It's like the most basic things of reality, our most basic concepts, are called into question. And I suppose it's not bad for any of us sometimes to think through the basic things that we believe and really take a closer look at them. Well, finally, the big day arrives. The day of the execution comes. After, I think he was in the jail, I mean, each chapter was the day that he was there. So 20 days after he's given the sentence, the day of the execution comes. And he is led into the public square, and he's brought up upon the block. And Pierre is with him, as he said. He's going to climb the scaffolding with him. Because, as I said, his roommate turned out to be the executioner. Now, before his death, a city official climbs up there with them and starts to make a speech. So what does he say as this prisoner is about to get his head chopped off? What is he addressing the townspeople? Because there's a whole bunch of folks who come to watch the beheading. I mean, I guess, you know, most folks, well, a lot of people, I guess, would want to see that. It's human nature. Anyway, he gets up there, and this is what he says. Townspeople, one brief remark. Lately in our streets, a tendency has been observed on the part of certain individuals of the younger generation to walk so fast that we oldsters must move aside and step into puddles. I would also like to say that after tomorrow, a furniture exhibit will open at the corner of First Boulevard and Brigadier Street, and I sincerely hope to see all of you there. I also remind you that tonight there will be given, with sensational success, the new comic opera, Socrates Must Decrease. I have also been asked to tell you that the Kiefer Distributing Center has a large selection of ladies' belts, and the offer may not be repeated. Now I make way for other performers and hope, townspeople, that you are all in good health and lack nothing. Again, remember the context. A man is getting ready to have his head chopped off, and the mayor or whoever gets up and gives that speech. So I think, again, the question here is, the question that Nabokov, what he's dealing with here, is he's dealing with the basic questions of morality and tradition and culture. Things we tend to take all for granted because we're just so used to it. And then finally, his book ends, Invitation to a Beheading, with Cincinnatus getting his head chopped off. Or does it? The fact of the matter is critics argue over what happens at the end. Some say he does, others say he simply wills the scene away and it disappears. Let me read you a bit of the end of the book. He's brought up there to get his head chopped off. And to 10, Cincinnatus repeated, spreading out his arm. He's told him to count. I am not doing anything yet, said Monsieur Pierre with an extraneous note of grasping effort. And the shadows of his swing were already running along the boards when Cincinnatus begins counting loudly and firmly. One Cincinnatus was counting, but the other Cincinnatus had already stopped heeding the sound of the unnecessary count, which was fading away in the distance. See, sometimes there's one Cincinnatus, but sometimes there's two, maybe an alter ego. One Cincinnatus was counting, but the other Cincinnatus had already stopped heeding the sound, and with a clarity he had never experienced before, at first almost painful, so suddenly did it come. But then, suffusing him with joy, he reflected on what happened and asked himself, why am I here? Why am I lying like this? And having asked himself these simple questions, he answered them by getting up and looking around. So suddenly, there's two Cincinnatuses. And one of them says, what am I doing here? And he gets up and he looks around. What happens next? All around there was strange confusion. Though the headsman's swinging hips, the railings showed. On steps, the pale Irarian sat doubled up vomiting. The spectators were quite transparent and quite useless, and they all kept surging and moving away. Only the back rows, being painted rows, remained in one place. Cincinnatus slowly descended from the platform and walked through the shifting debris. He was overtaken by Roman, who was now many times smaller, and who was at the same time Rodriguez. What are you doing? He croaked, jumping up and down. You can't. It's dishonest towards him, toward everybody. Come back, lie down. After all, you were lying down. Everything was ready. Everything was finished. Cincinnatus brushed him aside, and he, with a bleak cry, ran off, already thinking only of his own safety. Little was left of the square. The platform had long since collapsed in a cloud of reddish dust. The last to rush past was a woman in a black shawl, earring, carrying the teeny executioner like a larva in her arms. The fallen trees lay flat and reliefless, while those that were still standing, although two-dimensional, with a literal shading on the trunk to suggest roundness, barely held on, and their branches to the ripping mesh of the sky. Everything was coming apart. Everything was falling. A spinning wind was picking up and whirling. Dust, rags, chips of painted wood, bits of of splattered gold and plaster, pasteboard, bricks, postered. An arid gloom fleeted. And amidst the dust and the falling things and the flapping scenery, Cincinnatus made his way in that direction where, to judge by the voices, stood beings akin to him. That's how it ended. Just like that. So, what does this all mean? What does it all mean? It's very strange. Very strange. You know, early on in the book, Cincinnatus asked a question. In this world, can there be any kind of security in the all, at all? That, in the end, I think is the essence of what this book is talking about. It's asking because the world Nabokov created, there just doesn't seem to be anything secure. Even reality itself is like that. And what about our world, about the things that exist, all the questions? How often have the most basic things we believe been challenged, shaken, overturned? How quickly you can build your life and suddenly it's destroyed? How often you might have things that you absolutely are certain of, only to have them all wiped out completely? Maybe that's why Jesus said, you know, do not store up yourselves treasure where moth does destroy or thieves break in, but store treasure in heaven. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be. In this book, Nabokov challenged our most basic assumptions on everything. And maybe we need to sit back and think about some of the things we believe as well.